It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps.
They can lie louder, but I can tell the truth longer.
We get so many politicians coming through. It's hard to tell who's there for coffee or who's there for J.C. Watts. I was there for J.C. Watts, Baptist minister, a member of Congress. This was a rising star in the Republican Party.
And the truth has to fight to get through.
He came to Pella, Iowa, to campaign for Rand Paul. And he said something that just was an epiphany for me, in the sense that I never understood why all of the conservative friends that I have, admire, respect, could think so differently than I on so many different topics. And he said that Democrats believe that all people are born good, and Republicans know that we're all born bad.
Our children's innocence is more threatened than ever before.
And somebody asked him a question about a shooter in Louisiana who killed a bunch of people at a theater. And he said, Democrats would say, oh, something bad happened to the man, maybe society, maybe it was the guns. And Republicans, he said, we know it's not the guns' fault. We know it's not society's fault. He's a bad man. We become good by being born again. And so there's this tension that probably goes all the way back to original sin. And when J.C. Watts laid that out for me, boom, there it is.
That's Robert Leonard. He's the news director of KAIA and KRLS in Pella, Iowa. And original sin, Adam and Eve and the serpent, humanity's fall from grace, could a Bible story really have that much effect on lives and politics today? Let's go back to Robert.
Well, I am not a theologian, but the way that he laid this out and how the role of original sin in that people are bad, if you start with the premise that we're bad, which is, you know, original sin, and I don't know, and he's taking it to one of the extremes where it's really a bad thing. I'm a lapsed Lutheran, and so when I was raised, you know, original sin was there, but it wasn't anything that, I don't know if it drove our worldview or not. It just sort of set the stage, but it drives his worldview. And so then, if original sin is so powerful, and we only become good by being saved, and then we want to rely on the church and not the state, whenever Democrats want the state to do something that Republicans think that the church or maybe the family should do, it's a slap in the face of the church.
Hmm. What did people think of what J.C. Watts was saying about this difference between Republicans and liberals about whether you're born good or born bad? Did they like that? Did they agree?
They just nodded. They sort of, the ones that were there just sort of accepted it. People are very polite about it, but a lot of my Republican friends, they disdain liberals. That we are weak, we are enabling people, we're taking money. Liberals don't admire the military. They've there is a bit of fear that their world is under attack by liberals.
Hmm. And yet there you are, living in the same community, and you're liberal, and you're probably not the only liberal. Do you feel like your conservative neighbors have disdain or loathing for you?
Oh, probably some of them do. But most of them operate day to day without that problem. We just all, you know, everybody gets along and we solve problems. But, you know, when we start talking about politics, it really gets down to it. I'm sure that there are probably plenty of people that think that, you know, I'm morally weak.
Hmm.
And it's different out here in rural America. I mean, it's like I was talking with somebody today, you know, in emergency management. If I have a heart attack at home, it's going to be volunteers that come save my life. In the big cities of the East and West Coast, that would be unheard of. We are independent. We rely on each other. The church is the big social network that helps hold society together. And so a lot of times people in big cities don't get that. We see the infrastructure getting built in the big cities. We will spend millions of dollars to save 12 seconds off a big city dweller's commute and let our farm-to-market roads fall apart. Mm. And so there's this tension that relates to the urban-rural divide, but also, you know, probably goes all the way back to original sin.
You're in Bible Belt, Iowa. The majority of your neighbors go to church, were raised in the church?
Yeah, the majority. Yeah. A lot of people go to church. A lot of people go to church 3 days a week, and they volunteer for church. And these are hardworking people. They're, you know, sometimes, you know, people have two or three jobs. They'll sell, oh, Scentsy or Avon or something on the side, and then they'll volunteer in the community. They'll be a volunteer firefighter. They'll volunteer at church. They're just hardworking people. And
they don't want people.
They're great people. And that's why I wanted to get at the roots of this.
Hmm. What do you think? I mean, do you think humans are born bad?
Well, what I think is really pretty irrelevant. I think that I will say that altruism, if you look at evolutionary biology and our evolutionary history, there's, you know, reason to believe that altruism was an adaptation and that we all sort of need to help each other out to survive. And there's been a lot of research to show that groups that cooperate better and organized are going to survive and others aren't. So I would, you know, what I think is irrelevant. I'm not a neuroscientist, an evolutionary biologist, or a theologian.
Mm.
But I think, yeah, I guess you've pushed me to it. One time I saw a street corner preacher, and there was a bunch of teenagers, middle schoolers or a little bit older. And this was at a festival, and they were walking by him, and he started telling them that they were sinners. You kids are sinners. Do you recognize that you're sinners? You are sinners, and you're only saved through Jesus. And the kids are looking, oh, you know, okay, okay. And the kids are nodding. They don't know what to do with this guy yelling at him. And he says, you are wretches. Do you know you are wretches? And I thought, well, those are beautiful, wonderful children. Don't say that to them. And then all of a sudden, the word wretch came to me, that beloved song that so many people love, Amazing Grace, saved a wretch like me. And it's just like, that's not a premise that I'm willing to work off of, just to be honest with you. Those children aren't wretches. They're wonderful, beautiful human beings. And I so badly wanted to say something, but I didn't have the courage. Maybe I didn't want to interrupt. Maybe I thought the kids should handle themselves, but it was that, you know, it's just, I think that we're good.
So I'm curious, having realized that there is this deep divide between liberal and conservative worldviews that goes back to this ancient notion of original sin, have you thought about how to bridge that?
Well, actually, I have. I have a friend who was a pastor at a Christian school. He said, I was raised when I was a kid that God is a Republican. And if you love God, you will vote Republican. He said, I was in my 20s before I realized the world was more complex. And so I think there's a movement. I think the Christian left is rising, and so they are coming up against the Christian right and some of the things that we hear, the stridency of Ted Cruz and Mike Huckabee and the treatment of refugees and the poor and the downtrodden, and coupled in with this prosperity gospel that's risen in the last 20 years or so. There's the Christian left. I think they're starting to get strong. I think that if Republicans teach that God is a Republican, there's a lot of people like me and in the Christian left that were raised that Jesus was a Democrat.
You live in a small town, and you're talking about small town communities. Is there fallout for you in saying and writing some of this stuff?
Oh, a little bit, but you know, people are used to me. I'm on the radio every day, and they're used to me, and they understand my personality, and that I'm trying to learn, and that they're more than willing to teach me and appreciate me, and most of them, you know, are fond of me, and so I'm pretty lucky.
They're probably praying for you.
Oh, I'm sure they are. I'm sure they are.
That's Robert Leonard. He's the news director of KAIA and KRLS in Pella, Iowa. And if you want to read the fascinating piece he wrote for the New York Times about his neighbors and original sin, just head over to our website at ttbook.org.
So if you weren't raised Christian, or if you haven't spent much time in church, you might feel like the doctrine of original sin doesn't have much to do with you. Well, maybe not, but when you start to pay attention, you can see messages about salvation and grace, good and evil in the most secular spaces, like ads for diet soda, luxury cars, beach vacations. And that's not all. In a new book called Born Bad, historian James Boyce argues that the Christian doctrine of original sin is the foundation of Western thought. Steve Paulson sat down to talk with him.
James, you make this really audacious claim that the idea of original sin has been way more influential in the Western world than we realize. And you say we can date rather precisely when original sin became part of official Christian doctrine. It was in the early 5th century AD.
Yes, it's not that it's just in the Bible. Christians just believe it because it's in the Bible. And I mean, if we need any proof of that, of course, is that the other faiths and traditions that believe in the Genesis story, that share the Genesis account of Adam and Eve and the fall from the Garden of Eden, they share exactly the same text and yet don't believe in original sin because they read and understand that story differently. They have a different interpretation of Adam and Eve, Jewish people, Muslim people, and even Eastern Christians don't have that idea of inherited guilt. So it's only a Western story. And interestingly, this doctrine wasn't fixed by the church until the early 5th century, just as the Roman Empire was breaking up. So just at the very beginning, as the West was moving away from the East, so Western culture was beginning, we have this new understanding of a new fixed dogma emerging of original sin. And so that's why I said very at the very beginning of Western culture. And it's these turbulent times as the barbarian tribes are moving into the Western Roman Empire, the central political authority is breaking down, and the Catholic Church is really becoming a substitute for both for that temporal power as well as religious power. And at the very centre of its ideological claim, at the very centre of its claim to a spiritual and political authority, is the idea of original sin.
And it was really the work of St. Augustine who kind of shaped Western Christianity in the early 5th century. He's the one who kind of set a lot of the Roman Catholic doctrines that have come down to us today.
Exactly. So he's the pivotal figure here. He formulated them in the doctrine, and he was a great activist as well and a political operator as well as a brilliant theologian and philosopher. And he communicated his ideas and he pushed them. I mean, great cultural wars of the early 5th century were fought over this idea of original sin because there was a lot of resistance to the idea, but Augustine won.
You make the case that the doctrine of original sin has been very important for our political and economic institutions. Where do we see this?
Well, you see it nowhere more clearly in many ways than the United States. The influence of Calvinism, of course, in the early political thought and not just the religious thought of the United States and the understandings of democracy were profoundly shaped by the ideas of human nature that had come out of the doctrine of original sin, which was so central to Calvinism.
And you see this in the U.S. Constitution, right? I mean, the founding fathers wanted to create a government to manage what they considered to be our inherent selfishness.
Yes. The idea of original sin and that both gave confidence to those who were looking for independence, because we need to remember at the same time that original sin emphasises the profound innate selfishness and brokenness and sinfulness of people, there's also a sort of radical equality there, because the King of England is just as much a sinner in the eyes of God as a struggling, you know, farmer in New England. So that the poorest person is spiritually equal to the most politically powerful. In the eyes of God, they are the same. They are a sinner equally in need of salvation. It's like it's been sitting there almost dormant for 1,000 years, the political implications of Augustine's doctrine suddenly break out in America.
The irony is that a lot of those founding fathers did not like the influence of religion in government. I mean, they wanted to create a framework for our country that was not religious, and yet you're saying that they were drawing on these sort of deep religious ideas of original sin.
There's many discussions about the need, as you say, in the Constitution. This is why there is so many checks and balances, which no doubt many of you and indeed many of us around the world at the moment are very grateful to the founding fathers for those checks and balances, because they recognised that even the US president was a sinner. That was how they understood human nature. And even the people, even the will of the people was potentially done. You couldn't, because they were very concerned to protect minorities from the will of the people. And this was underpinned by this idea of the limits of human nature, which is in stark contrast, for example, to the French Revolution at the similar time. Hmm. The idealism of those engaged in the French Revolution, they'd rejected that, what they saw as that Catholic idea of human nature and of original sin, and really believed in the potential perfection of humankind.
Mm-hmm. Now, it would be tempting to think that, okay, this is all just sort of really antiquated thinking. So, I mean, unless you are a Catholic in good standing today, I mean, you're pretty much that you'd think, oh, original sin, this is, this sort of ancient myth. But if we skip ahead to the 20th century, you make the case that Freud, the founder of modern psychology, is his ideas of our instinctual drives, with sex and aggression and, how we're, we're controlled by these inherent passions. You say that these come right out of the idea of original sin.
Freud was not a Christian, and he was not a believer, because he's from a Jewish background, but he's an atheist. He doesn't believe in God. But if you read Freudian thought, and you can't, and the cultural continuity there is so close that I'm pointing this out. I'm asking to the reader, look at this. This idea that had shaped the Western world for 1500 years, are we really so confident and arrogant to believe that it just disappeared when people stopped believing in the religious idea? Did Christianity's influence just fade away? Have a look at some of these thinkers. Look at Freud. What does he say? Deep in our most core basic instincts, we're driven by these instinctual drives. Sex and tendency to violence are there at the core of our experience.
That's why we need civilization. We need civilization, society, to rein in those inherent selfish and destructive instincts.
And it's incredibly vulnerable. I mean, at an individual level, our superego is trying to suppress them. And we've got civilization at our social level trying to suppress and control. But he's always worried that it's just going to break out. These ideas really struck a resonant chord and permeated widely in the culture. Why? Because, I suggest, we already believed them to be true. They gave a secular language to our old religious understanding that we already understood to be true. And, I mean, I even, provocatively make this point that Richard Dawkins is now doing
Richard
the same
Dawkins,
thing.
The most famous atheist in the world. You're saying that his idea of the selfish gene is another extension of sort of this notion that we're just driven by our genes, by the selfish gene, which you make the point is sort of is rooted in the notion of original sin.
In a way, because we dismissed the idea of original sin, we had this sort of secular modern scientific arrogance that we were free from this religious past, who 1,500 years of history had suddenly been ended by Charles Darwin. We could start again, and this is what Dawkins believes. That he's an individual free from this past, and we can all be so. My understanding is different. I have a more sort of, I suppose, limited view of what we can do as an individual, that all of us, the same way that we're made by our parents, I would say it a bit like us in our relationship with our families of origin. Part of that is coming to terms with accepting our family of origin and to the extent to which that shaped us. We can never be totally free of our parental influence. And if we pretend that we are, if we actually believe in the illusion that we can just become someone else and a totally new human being who... That is actually when we'd be most trapped by the past. And so I think Dawkins' big mistake is to believe that he can be free of this inheritance. And so unintentionally, he doesn't really understand that inheritance, and so unintentionally reproduces many aspects of it in his thought.
is the doctrine of original sin really a problem? I mean, you know, the Western culture in many senses has done quite well in world history. You know, is there anything wrong with this idea?
I think it's the source. For me, it's not so much whether it's wrong or right. It is part of our inheritance. It's the source of Western creativity. And that sort of dis-ease, if you like, that unsettledness that we have, we're not a content people. When the just to be human, just to be who we are, cause is not never quite enough.
But there also seems to be some inherent cruelty in this idea of original sin. I mean, that a one-month-old baby could actually be a sinner, or that you have to forcibly convert people to believe in your doctrine so that they will be saved. What do you make of that?
Yeah, there's a barbarity there. To most people, it is now. I mean, to most people of sensitivity through Western history, it always has been. This was one of the things that was put to Augustine that was fought about in the 5th century and has been resisted ever since. I mean, this people cannot accept, and for obvious good reasons, the idea that a one day, 1 hour, 1 minute old baby is a sinner. Probably the point at which the debate over the last 1,500 years has always got focused on, and the point where it's come back to, Steve, is your question is about the newborn child and how you understand that newborn baby sort of gets to the crux of the question, and that has been contested and debated. And what's interesting, even today, while the Catholic Church has moved a long way from that, it hasn't moved all the way because it doesn't want to completely undermine the basis of the necessity of a Catholic baptism to be certain of salvation. I mean, a simple tweet from this wonderful Pope, the extraordinary Pope that we have now, a simple tweet, he likes to tweet. He could just tweet that all newborn babies, if they die before a baptism, will be welcomed by God in heaven. This would actually be radical.
James Boyce is the author of Born Bad, Original Sin and the Making of the Western World. Steve Balsam talked with him from his home in Tasmania. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI. Public Radio International. This hour, we're talking about original sin, which is a Christian doctrine, arguably the most important doctrine in the church. I mean, think about it. Adam and Eve fall from grace, and ever since then, humans are born into sin. We need to be saved, and who's there to save us? Jesus. That's the foundation of Christianity. But there are a few Christians who don't exactly agree. Danielle Schroyer is a young theologian and former pastor, and she's the author of a new book called Original Blessing, Putting Sin in Its Rightful Place, which is a rebuke to that doctrine of original sin. She told Charles Monroe Kane that for her, what happened in the Garden of Eden is a story of original blessing.
I first heard that phrase from a book by Matthew Fox, who is a priest, who wrote a book about 20 years ago called Original Blessing, in which he talks about how the foundation of our faith is a spirituality that involves humanity and nature and God all in harmony with one another. It certainly wasn't something that I had read in seminary or certainly in undergrad. People have asked me, why did you name your book Original Blessing? There's already a book called Original Blessing. And I said, because I want everyone to start using this phrase. We don't need to keep reinventing the wheel. Like Matthew Fox found the absolute perfect phrase for this thing. And so I don't feel the need to come up with a new one. Like this is, I hope that we just keep saying it over and over again until it becomes very, very common for people to know what Original Blessing is.
You know, it's funny. I went to a Christian school as well, and I read the same book you did. And when I read that book, it blew me away. And I asked my professor, I said, you know, it's really easy to think about original sin because there's a moment, right? Eve gives Adam the apple. Apple, you know, is bitten by Adam, and there it is. There's your original sin. And I said, well, it seems like this is so almost too nuanced for really to understand. Where's the moment of the blessing? And he said, it's the first moment. It's that simple. What about you? How do you explain to a 10-year-old in a Baptist church original blessing in their mindset?
You are in a relationship with God. God started it, and God is sticking with it. Original sin has decided to start by saying, your problem is that you're sinful and that you don't have a relationship with God. Original blessing starts by saying, hey, did you know that you already have a relationship with God and that God is not quitting on that? Now, what are you going to do about it? To me, that's just so much more, first of all, faithful to Scripture. And secondly, it's also just more compelling. It happens to be a lot more compelling to people who are looking to find some sense of spiritual connection in their lives to say, haven't you had those moments, regardless of what you've, quote, confessed or said from the front or believed or whether you've attended a church or a synagogue or anything? Don't you have these moments where you've experienced the presence of God? Well, of course you have, because you already have that relationship. It's part of who you are as a human, just by default.
Danielle, I've got to ask you the $10,000 question of the day here, hearing you talk. Okay. What do you need Jesus for then, right? Isn't Jesus there to, like, save you from your sins? Isn't that the whole absolute basic tenet of Christianity? You're born a sinner and Jesus saves you from your sins so you don't go to hell. So what do you need Jesus for?
That is exactly the question that many, many people have asked me.
I bet.
This is going to undo everything. The way that American Christianity and Western Christianity broadly has limited Jesus to this transaction of sin for us, that Jesus is just going to fix our sin. It, first of all, is very self-serving for us, that Jesus is this very self-serving fixer for us. I don't think there's any healthy relationship in the whole wide world that's sacred and honoring that has that sort of mentality to it. Like, there's no healthy marriage that's like, I'm just here for you to fix these things for me. You know, that tends to go badly.
Yeah.
So I think that's also true for our relationship with Jesus. As a child, I was just so enamored with this person, Jesus, and to limit him in such a way seems so violating to me of that holiness that I feel about him as a person.
Can you do me a favor? Turn to page 27.
Okay.
I want you to read to me the section. It's a huge paragraph. It's in the middle. It's the paragraph in the middle of all the doctrine. If you could just read it to our listeners.
In its most basic terms, the doctrine of original sin argues two things. One, that when Adam and Eve ate the fruit in the garden, something negatively and permanently shifted in their nature. And two, this nature has been passed on to every human being since. This sin nature is described in a number of different ways across denominations, but the themes are consistent. Catholics say we lost our original holiness and justice. Methodists say we are inclined to evil continually. The Westminster Larger Catechism, used by Presbyterians and other Reformed denominations, says we are made opposite unto all that is spiritually good and wholly inclined to all evil, and that continually. National Baptists say our nature is positively inclined to evil. The prize goes to the Lutheran Book of Concord, though, which not only states that original sin is the entire absence of all good, but also that original sin gives us a deep, wicked, horrible, fathomless, inscrutable, and unspeakable corruption of the entire nature and all its powers. Yikes.
Yikes. Okay, Danielle, yikes. Why are you right? Like every single Christian believes that we are horrible sinners, all of us. Why the disconnect? Why aren't they getting the blessing? What happened? What's going on?
You know, I think what happened is we started looking at scripture and particularly at the cross in a legal way. And I think that that's one of the issues that changed us. We have this sin. We don't know what to do about it. How is Jesus going to fix this for us? And so we started by putting the focus on us. Like, we have a problem and we need to fix it, and we're going to make sure that we make this thing so that God fixes it for us.
You seem to be the only one or very few of the people that are, quote unquote, evolving on this issue. And a lot of other issues have changed for all Christians, and they don't do it anymore. You know, why are they still falling back on this idea that we are born bad instead of born good?
That is a really good question, although I do think that more people question this than you may anticipate. One of the reasons I wrote this book is because I have run into so many people who really do think there's a problem with original sin, but they just don't really know what to believe in its place. And even if they have an inkling of what to believe in its place, they really just, they can't defend it or talk to friends about it or something. And so I also really wrote this book just to give people a chance to say, okay, here, I'm nerdy enough to spend a lot of time reading theology books, and so here's one way that we could talk about this that I think is really honoring to Scripture and to even our Christian tradition, but sort of pulls us back from that chasm of being so focused on original sin, because it wasn't always this way. I mean, I say often, Jesus didn't believe in original sin, and we shouldn't either. The idea that Jesus or Paul or the disciples had this Western 20th century concept of original sin is just, it's not true.
If you think that you're born bad and you think that you're separated from creation, then that's going to affect all sorts of stuff in your personal life and how you make decisions in life. You know what I mean? Like, it seems like this philosophy of original sin has some ramifications beyond God.
Oh, certainly. I think it has a lot to do, in fact, with the way that we treat one another and the way that we treat creation. One of the things that I talk about is how accepting and living into original blessing isn't free. I mean, the cost of blessing is to see the world the way God sees the world. And when we rest in original blessing, we can't help but realize that we are connected to everyone else as well. When Jesus tells us, pray for your enemies, bless those who persecute you, that's not just a command. It's something that comes from the fact that we know that our enemy is, even at the end of the day, still beloved by God. Now, does God honor and respect everything that we ever do? No. Sometimes do we need to stand up against injustice and violence and stop those people from doing those things? Absolutely. But underneath that, we cannot reject the dignity that's inherent in those people because they are beloved by God. And that actually makes us more peaceful and gracious in the way that we respond to others.
When I was a child, I was a teenage preacher. And
wow.
I also, I went on to be an evangelical missionary in some different countries. And that's the life I lived. I can tell you right now, the way you're talking and the words you were using would have been labeled of Satan from me and people that were around me. And you would have been dismissed. Without a question, you would
yes.
be dismissed. For people out there that aren't Christian or aren't very steeped in doctrine, can you please help us understand what you're talking about is blasphemy? It's a big deal. This isn't some minor quibble. My mom would be praying for you for years. She heard you talk.
I know. I've gotten some emails, and God bless them. I try to think in that moment, they really are thinking of me. You know, they're trying to help, or they're thinking of me. But it just doesn't say that. I mean, the hard thing for me is that there is a lot of room for interpretation in Scripture, but there are certain lines, and I have spent enough time reading Genesis 3 over and over and over again in Hebrew and in English, and I've looked over those passages from Paul and, you know, all of those places, and I'm just not convinced that there's any place in Scripture that argues for an inborn sin nature that is irreversible and that inclines us to evil in such a way that we are incapable of doing good. It doesn't say that. And so to me, I mean, the irony is that I think it's really blasphemous for us to reject this gift that God has given us freely.
Wow, fighting words. I like that.
No, I really do.
No,
think
I understand.
That's true.
So I'm an evangelical teenager. I'm upset by what you're saying. And I say to
right?
my follow up would be, I know exactly what my follow up would be. My follow up would have been, so do you need Jesus then to be saved?
Yes, of course you need Jesus. But the reason that you need Jesus is so much more than just, certainly we sin. That's actually half of the point of my book. The reason it's called Putting Sin in Its Rightful Place isn't that I'm trying to say, oh, we don't need Jesus. We don't need, we're all fine. Everything's good. Nobody sins. No, the point is, of course we do. And Jesus is this model for us in how to be human. But we can't do that without accepting original blessing. We're just not going to get very far. Every spiritual person that I trust and that I respect in the world is somebody that is grounded in the unwavering love of God. In original sin, there's the sense in which you're always on the hook for the shame and the guilt and the things that you're doing wrong. And I think it's deeply powerful and important for us to be responsible human beings. I think we do that, though, by resting in this sense of unconditional love that comes from original blessing.
Danielle Schroyer is a theologian and former pastor, and her book is called Original Blessing, Putting Sin in Its Rightful Place. She talked with Charles Monroe Cain. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. What we're going to hear next is really three stories wrapped around each other. The first is something that really happened, a famous lynching in Marion, Indiana, in the summer of 1930. The second is the story of the song Strange Fruit, which was inspired by that lynching. And the third is a new novel which begins on that terrible day. The novel is called The Evening Road. It's by Laird Hunt, and this is how he came to write it.
6 or 7 years ago, I had NPR on, and there was a story that came on the radio called Strange Fruit, Anniversary of a Lynching.
In August of 1930, a photographer took a picture of two black teenagers hanging by their necks from a tree in the town square of Marion, Indiana. The picture shows the crowd gathered around, pointing at the bodies, some smiling. Today, it's probably the most iconic photograph of lynching in America. After seeing that photograph, a high school teacher in the Bronx named Abel Mirapol wrote a poem, which he set to music. That song, Strange Fruit, was later made famous by Billie Holiday.
Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves.
The basic event on August 6, 1930, a young white man was shot, and three young black men, one of them was only 16 years old, were arrested for this crime and put into jail in Marion, Indiana. While they were in jail, in the following hours, the young white man died. His name was Claude Dieter. This news spread and turned into a mob situation, and the mob broke into the Marion jail with sledgehammers and took the two older young men out and lynched them. And the third, James Cameron, was spared just at the very last minute. Marion, Indiana is about an hour away from my family's farm in rural Indiana, where I did a lot of my growing up with my grandmother, the two of us in this big rambling farmhouse. And the thing that really struck me was, and I hadn't really thought about it before, was that the lynching had never been mentioned all the years I lived in Indiana. My grandmother was forever talking about her earlier days, and that would have been certainly right in the middle of them.
I can never forget that night.
That NPR radio show that I mentioned, it's really an extraordinary program that has the voice of James Cameron.
I was in there about 3 hours when daylight approached, and they were gathering in small knots of people, 8 to 10 people at a time, and shaking fists up at the jail, and the crowds kept getting bigger and bigger all during the day.
And then people who had attended the event, who were then in their later years. There is a recording in particular of an older woman who describes how she heard about the event.
I came down from the office, and Grendel said, "Where are you going, kiddo?" And I said, "Well, I'm going home. I said, I've finished my day's work."
Which was someone, perhaps a colleague, a friend, saying, "You know, you better stick around."
And I said, "Well, what's going on?" I said, "I haven't heard anything." And he said, "Well, they're going to lynch the niggers." And I said, "Oh, Grendel, you're kidding." And he said, "No, I'm not." He said, "You better stick around." So there's going to be some excitement.
And she jumps in the car, and they drive off to Marion together. And that in and of itself was interesting. But it's just her last comment. And she's laughing a little nervously as she says this.
I'd wished 1,000 times I hadn't been so inquisitive.
It was really that stuck with me, because she's not saying this was an awful thing that happened. This was a horrible thing that happened. She's talking about how she wished she hadn't seen it. And you can read all kinds of things into her words. But there was something about that ambivalence at the root of what she was saying that really struck me. And I wanted to explore that.
Well, you tell this story, the story of this day, through the eyes of two different women, Audie Lee Henshaw and Calla Destry, and you write wonderful women characters, strong-minded, strong-willed women with very distinctive voices. And these two are, you know, in your tradition. So tell us about Audie Lee Henshaw. I mean, we meet her on the first page, right? And she's sharpening pencils and fantasizing using them to stab her boss.
that's Audie Lee right there. No question about it. And, you know, so she's the character who grew out of my encounter with that voice on the radio. Of course, she's not that woman. She is very much her own character. And I've been interested in writing the voices of women, stories told by women, for a good little while now. These women I've been moved to write, whose voices have in many ways possessed me, are, to me at least, an interesting blend of a kind of ferocious hunger to encounter the world with all its good and all its bad, to understand it and take a great big bite out of it.
So Audie Lee's boss is the one who tells you there's going to be this lynching and they should go see it. And on the way there, they stop for a catfish supper. This would be a good place to ask you to read a bit, something that kind of gives us a sense.
Yeah, so they have stopped off. They're on their way to the lynching, and they've picked up her husband along the way and decided they're hungry, and they'll get a bite to eat. And as you say, there is a kind of carnival-like atmosphere to the whole proceeding. And everybody at this church supper is aware of the event that's going to happen. So they're sort of stirred up. And one of the main ringleaders in this is this local wannabe politician. "It's a patriotic thing you're doing, madam," he said, and gave a little bow of his head that set his chin flaps to flopping. "Going to the lynching is patriotic? Didn't you hear my speech?" "Some of it." "And how'd you find it, that portion that you heard?" He gave a great big smile and more than I liked of a look at his pink gums. I have never liked someone showed too much gum. I shrugged. The smile fell off his face and into the brown grass. "Was it that bad? You want the truth? I miss most of it." This seemed to perk him up. "But you liked what you heard? A torch of clarity to burn bright across the countryside during dark days. That's got a winner's ring to it, wouldn't you agree? I worked hard on that part." "You said that? About the lynching? The one that's happening today?" "Yes, madam, I did. It's a difficult thing, a harsh thing, but it will burn things clear, bring us back into balance. The hardest things always do." "Well, I'll give it to you," I said. "That part is pretty good." He started to say something else, stopped, sneaked a look down the front of my dress, then showed me his gums again.
Now, one strange note is the word choice you use in the book. Rather than refer to characters as black or white, you came up with cornflower and corn silk. Why?
When I did the first draft of the novel, it's quite short, and it uses the standard racial epithets of the time. And I still have that draft. I printed it out and read through it, and it was so painful to read it using those terms, that terminology. And
because they carry so much weight, so much history?
So much weight, so much history, and it's damaging history.
Mm-hmm.
And I, on that draft, I have crossed out all of those epithets and inserted the word colored. And even that, even though it's period appropriate, just wasn't working for me. And I was casting about, not quite sure how I was going to move forward. And I thought of that word colored, and then I thought of paint colors. And I looked in a paint catalog and came across, I'm not sure if it was corn silk or cornflower first, but they were both in there, colors of paint. And so I swapped the words out, thinking that once I had gone farther with the novel, completed it, I would switch back. But I realized that not only did it help me to write this book, early readers talked about how it helped them to read the book.
So we should talk about your other strong woman character who picks up the story of this day from Audie Lee Henshaw, and this is Calla Destry. Can you tell us about her?
So Calla is in Marion on the day of the lynching. She lives there. She's a teenager. She's Black, and she wants to get out of town, right? So there were some people put the number at 10,000 people poured into witness this event on that day. And of course, the African-American population either bolted their doors and pulled the shades or got out of town. But her departure is complicated and leads her down many a difficult road.
Calla winds up, actually, her route takes her through town, and she sees this whole, she calls it the Death Carnival. Could you read a little bit of her description of that?
Sure. None of it was what I had expected. None of it was what I had thought, which was Klan hats and Klan robes and Klan torches and maybe a few ugly corn silk men with bleeding, chaw-filled mouths. No, this was corn silks drinking out of bottles in the bright sunshine, corn silk families reclining in the shade of the killing trees. There were women and babies and little boys juggling apples and bulldogs slobbering and biting at their own tails. This wasn't something away on over there, like a picture show. This was all around. This was right next to me. I drove slow because that's all I could do, and went past a little girl in a green dress who was draped like limp lettuce over her father's shoulder. She gave me a sleepy smile, lifted her little hand, and said hi in a soft voice as I went by, and I rolled up my window. There was a mailman standing next to her father, holding a picture of the governor and a tall gal in a fancy blue dress next to him. I saw people I recognized everywhere I looked. A man from the hardware store where Uncle D bought supplies, a teenage girl who sold papers at the interurban station, a boy who was always on his bright orange bicycle and who was on it today.
The whole scene feels surreal. These ordinary people that she's seen in daily life who have revealed this kind of monstrous side. And it has such resonance today. I mean, as a white person with deep Midwestern roots myself, reading that, it's really hard not to think, what would I have been doing had I been a child or alive then?
Well, absolutely. And, I have often posed that question about myself, but also about my family. I don't know what they were doing that day. And
do you want to know?
You know, I don't know. Sure, if my grandmother was still with us, she's left us, and alas, I would ask her the question, and she would have spoken frankly about it. I'm quite sure.
But the thing is, your grandmother growing up there, she would have known people who did go to that lynching, and so now you don't know which people you might have met when you were growing up had attended it, and you don't know how that might have affected her relationships with them. It's so strange to think about how all of this can be forgotten, hushed up.
You know, there was an African-American community near Marion, Indiana, just a few miles away, called Weaver, Indiana. And I was really, when I read about this, I was really interested. I wanted to go visit. And so I went to what was supposed to be Weaver following Google Maps. And what I found was a crossroads with a sign that said, this is where Weaver was. And, you know, it's unbelievably powerful to me, potent as a symbol. Maybe it was people moving away for whatever reason, but it sure feels awfully linked to those events of August 7th, 1930, that over time, that just wouldn't be a tenable position to stay there.
I want to ask you to leave us with one more reading. It's a powerful one, but you were talking about the heat. And this is Calla remembering the events of that day, which really kind of never leave her.
She says, I kept hearing it in my head, keep hearing it, down the years and always banging at my door. And when it comes, when I'm thinking back, the devil hot, blister bright afternoon sky I'm driving through turns to black, and the air grows scorching ever hotter, and the corn silk's heads glow red with the heat of it, and they cackle and roar and move in their glowing thousands for the jail. I am in the crowd and above it, and the sheriff steps aside and they take their sledgehammers to the walls and beat their way in. Then they are pouring across the tile floors and past the iron doors and through the hallways of the big jail. And there I go pouring with them. And as we pour, there are shouts about God and about country and about honor and about truth and about death and death and death. And we pour up the stairs and find where they are holding the boys. I'm not dreaming, it's something I'm seeing. I'm there and I tell them to stop. And I'm not alone in telling them. There are hundreds of us, thousands, many thousands, millions even, and the earth joins us and the sky and the moon and the stars, and we say stop, but they do not stop. The first boy is beat to death right there, then dragged around and hung from the bars on the cell window. Then one by one they take the others. They drag them dead and about to be dead through the night and the heat and the roaring crowd and the universe twitching to the killing trees.
Thank you. I just don't even know what to say after that passage. It's an extraordinary piece of writing, and it's overwhelming.
It kind of got to me too a little bit.
Yeah. Thanks. Laird Hunt's new novel is called The Evening Road. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it and maybe heard something worth sharing. Thanks also to the wonderful people at Radio Diaries for use of their story, Strange Fruit. To hear the whole thing, visit their website. To the best of our knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced this hour. He had help from Raymond Tungekar, Doug Gordon, and Mark Rickers. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strangeamps. We'll be back next week.
Blood on the leaves and blood at the root, black bodies swinging in the southern.
PRI, Public Radio International.